This is a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
Right here we have author Deirdre Brown coming in here to talk about a latest book that she co-authored about Māori art history called Toi Te Mana. Exceptional stuff. Morena, Deirdre, how you doing?
Morena, I'm doing well, Zach. How are you?
Nice. Yeah, good. It's a bit muggy here. It's a bit warm and cloudy. It's a weird kind of humid vibe, which I'm not used to. I'm sure being from living in Tamaki, you're very used to it, but I'm not a fan of it, eh? I don't know how people in Tamaki do it.
Oh, we manage. It's when it starts pouring with rain it becomes an issue.
That's, yeah, very good point. Very, very good point. We're used to that. See, it's completely different roles here. Completely different roles. But yeah, you've recently put out this massive tome, which essentially is a huge historical retelling and analysis of Māori art. And I just want to say, I really appreciate the work you're doing here. It seems incredibly vital. And before we get into this kōrero, I think we should pay our respects to someone who helped you and your co-author, Ngāri Noa Ellis. Is that the name?
Yes. Ngāri Noa Ellis is the other co-author, yes.
Yes, I think we should pay our respects to Professor Jonathan Ngarimu Mane Fioki, who played a key part in the book's creation and who sadly passed away in 2014, just 2 years into the book's creation. Jonathan was a professor of fine art at the Elam School of Fine Arts, who had spoke on why a book like this is so crucial for Māori and Indigenous art and art historical scholarships. Can you speak to the impact that he had on this book and, I guess, the broader field of Māori art?
Yeah, kia ora. And it's great to be remembering Jonathan at this time because, as you said, it's been just over 10 years since he passed away. So Jonathan was an incredible person. He trained as a Māori modernist painter and was actually in the very first Māori contemporary art exhibition in Christchurch in 1966 as a young painter, then went off to the Courtauld Institute and got a degree in art history from there, and had a career teaching European art history, but of course he was Ngāpuhi, and he was one of the early adopters of Māori art history, along with Ngahuia Te Awa Kōtuku, mm-hmm. who was Ngāri Noa's mentor. Mm-hmm. I got to meet Jonathan when he mentored me when I worked at the University of Canterbury. We worked together, and I was teaching Māori art history. So he was a beginner of the movement that came up, this Māori art history movement. He was a practitioner himself, so he had great relationships with people already in Māori art. And all three of us, me, Jonathan and Ngāri Noa, found ourselves at the University of Auckland working together. I think Jonathan joined us in 2010. But we started shaping up an idea. We'd all been approached to write books on Māori art history. We thought, well, maybe we'd collaborate and write one really great one that represented three lifetimes of work together, and mm-hmm. that's what we set off to do.
Yeah, and indeed, and it states in the preface that the Waitangi Tribunal report on Māori cultural property rights named Ko Aotearoa Tēnei was a major catalyst in creating this tome of knowledge. As the report stressed, that a greater understanding is essential for the survival of Māori art. How do you feel you've done with this pukapuka that you've put up?
Yeah, so that claim, Y262, was really important because it looked at taonga Māori and their importance in Māori society and who could practice Māori art. And in some ways, we've followed on from their definitions there. So for us, Māori art is art made by anyone of Māori descent. And so Māori art can actually occur anywhere in the world. So our book has a global outlook and even has a chapter on Māori art in Australia where over 200,000 Māori people live, and the US and also the UK and Europe. So the intent of the book was to situate Māori art as one of the great art traditions of the world. That was particularly important for Jonathan, you know, knowing all the other art traditions of the world, but also for me and Ngāri Noa. So Y262 captures a moment, that Waitangi Tribunal claim, and, you know, we've come out of that impetus to look at taonga Māori from a Māori perspective and understand it in that way.
It's fascinating you touch on the international aspect because there's, highlights of Māori art making it to the Venice Biennale, and then also highlights of taonga that is still in, you know, foreign museums that should really come back home. So yeah, it's a totally all-encompassing text, and it uses a really, really interesting framework to convey all this knowledge. It uses the framework of ngā kite e toru, the three baskets of knowledge, and these are te kite tuatia, which focuses on art created in customary fashion, te kite tuaori, which features art developed from engagement with Pākehā and the changing dynamics of Māori relationships, as well as te kite aronui, which is a little bit more loosely defined, I felt, but it kind of traces the history of Māori art right before and post-World War II. That was my interpretation of it, at least. How does this framework kind of tell the story of Māori art that you wanted it to?
Yeah, that framework was quite important because in writing any kind of history, or in this case an art history, you're dealing with notions of time. And of course, we're dealing with Māori time, which is cyclical.
Mm.
But books tend to get read from cover to cover, so they're quite linear. And Western time is tends to be thought of in, as a linear fashion too, although others, you know, might choose to challenge that idea.
Mm.
So how do you present an art history in book form that takes into account cyclical notions of time, but also the way that we read a book, which is in some ways linear, although this book has been designed in ways that people can pick up in certain areas and put down, and some texts are shorter and some are longer.
Mm-hmm.
So, and how can we do that with cultural integrity? So it actually took us a year, and we wrote a whole other book about this to come up with this structure, which has got these three parts and relate to these three baskets of knowledge, which Tane brought down from the heavens. Mm-hmm. So that first one looks at what might be termed customary art, but we wanted to make it very clear, and this distinguishes this book from other art histories, that what we term customary Māori art for kairodako, Māori wood carving, fibre arts, rock art, is actually a continuing presence. It's not something that kind of stopped when James Cook stepped foot in Aotearoa, New Zealand. You know, it's still a big part of art today. So we wanted to represent that, and also how contemporary practitioners, through many different modes, which could be practices passed down or through other modes that they've come to these arts, you know, so how that is. So that's that first part. That second part, we were really interested in looking at what happened when European ideas, materials and technologies entered into Māori art,
mm-hmm.
and also the travel of Māori art outside of Aotearoa, New Zealand. So in some histories, it's sort of presented like a fatal impact, but actually there's this really interesting period where ideas are coming in. Māori exercise their self-determination over those ideas and bring them into their arts, and the arts change.
Yep.
And then that third one, as you said, that covers a whole variety of arts post-World War II. So we actually start with chapters that are looking at social reform within Māori society. Many art histories would probably situate the beginning of the contemporary period with the arrival of modernism. But if we look at not just Māori art, but I'd suggest all arts in New Zealand, it kind of, this contemporary period kind of starts off in the early 20th century, not within the modernist paradigm. So we're looking at the work of Se Apirana Ngata, Te Puia Hirangi, and Tahu Pōtiki Wiramu Rātana, and kind of creating, you know, some of them were reviving art, some of them were creating new arts, and that being the springboard for contemporary art upwards. So we were dealing with that three-part structure. Time, how do we represent time with integrity? But also, how do we represent practices and ensure that readers can see that they are continuing?
Sure. And speaking of representation, there's an active effort here to engage with Māori art history from a feminist lens as well as a queer lens, which led to some really, really intriguing discoveries. For example, the first Māori person to graduate from a tertiary art school was a wahine, Pauline Yearbury. What did incorporating these perspectives inform you about Māori art history? And do you think it'll challenge a lot of preconceptions that people may have about it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting observation, Zach, and I'm glad that you made it. You know, we've recently celebrated the 40th anniversary of the opening of the Te Māori exhibition, which was fantastic in many ways, but it did receive critique because of its focus on kairodako and stone, so focus on men's art. So Ngā Rino and I are both proud wahine toa from Ngāpuhi, and she's also Ngāti Porou. The representation of women's arts within the book was really important, but also stepping back further and thinking about gender. So there's work within the book that looks at male engagement with fibre arts, for example, and also queer. And Ngāi Reno's an expert in this, and particularly looking into Pokaido Rako and Māori wood carving and looking at the figures. And you can see the relationships. It's not just binary male-female. There's male-to-male, female-to-female. There's a lot of but figures that are gendered in a way that are not typically male or female. So we wanted to present that in the book, and also to present queer artists and queer art within the book as well. We think too that that fully represents ideas of Māori art in terms of gender and sexuality, potentially in a way that hasn't been done before.
Very nuanced and innovative stuff, really. In Te Kite Tuatia, you wrote a really fascinating piece about rock art. To my surprise, the distribution of rock art mostly pertains to North Otago and South Canterbury, which shows how much I know about the subject. You say that the distribution in Te Ika Amawi, the North Island, compared to Te Waipounamu, the South Island, comes down to a few factors, such as the availability of rock services, group preferences, and the limited national scope of archaeological surveys. You also added that we need to thoroughly identify and examine rock art sites before we can truly analyse their motifs and meanings. What's currently missing from the picture of our understandings of those motifs and meanings, and what efforts are underway to fill in those gaps?
Yeah, that really has been led by Ngaitahu. So you're in the centre of this, Zach, where you're situated now. Mm-hmm. Gerard O'Regan, who works for Otago Museum, he is an expert in rock art. He's Ngaitahu. And he actually peer-reviewed that chapter for us. So that was another aspect of the book where we were touching on tribally associated or iwi associated arts. We checked in with those iwi as well to make sure. So the leadership on this is coming from the South Island. And as you mentioned, that there are initiatives underway to document this better. You know, the rock art sites are easy to get to where they are. They're easy to look at, but there's a lot more that still needs to be explored. Bless you, Zach.
So, sneezing off mic, sorry. Don't know what's taken over me, but continue, sorry.
Yeah, so that's where it is at the moment. But the level of scholarship that's being undertaken into Waipounamu, into rock art, is just astonishing. And it is world-leading as well. The world looks towards the South Island for knowledge in this area.
And in terms of the motifs or meanings of, I guess, a lot of the rock art, you know, what is missing from that picture? What don't we understand quite yet?
Yeah, so it's really interesting to look at from an aesthetic perspective what is going on in those images. Mm. It's thought that a lot of them were made by moving bands of people as they were moving across the landscape, collecting food in a seasonal nature.
Yeah.
So they sheltered in these areas. They drew, as you'll see in other parts of the world. Incredible taniwha creatures, hybrid human creatures, hybrid bird-men creatures. So we don't know if those are great eagles or this is some imagining of humans in flight. Mm. You know, the role of the kuri, the Māori dog, is very prominent as well. And, of course, the thinking is that these images would have been all over these rock structures, but due to erosion over time, and that's just the natural passage of time, and also farming practices, a lot of them have been rubbed off or scrubbed off. So we're only getting a glimpse of what has been described as like the Sistine Chapel of Māori art, you know, these beautiful rock art structures.
Yeah, there's some really interesting pictures in there of some of the art from Rekohu, the Chatham Islands, where there's they're all done on tree bark, if I'm not mistaken, which I think I've actually seen in the flesh at Te Papa earlier in the year, but I might be tripping.
But, no, you're right. I saw it there too at Te Papa as well, some of those images. Mm. Some of them have been levered off the trees from time to time, which is a great shame. So they exist in other formats. But, you know, we talked a lot about Moriori art and not wanting to appropriate it into a book in Māori art. Mm. But that story of rock art, I don't think, can be told without acknowledging that other art tradition as well.
For sure, for sure. Shooting over to Te Kite Tuauri, you write about the art of utu, or reciprocal actions, and some of its gendered aspects. For example, the exchange of taonga / koha could be given for a variety of reasons, but when it comes to making peace, women were praised with Ngāti Porou leader and New Zealand war combatant, I can't remember the name off the top of my head, sorry, but one of them said, if peace is settled by men, it's an uneasy and treacherous peace, destined to break, whereas peace settled by women is firm and durable. And you likened the role of wahine in Māori social relationships to that of the wefts in a kākahu / traditional cloak, keeping the warps of the relationships together. Do you think that this is still a similar dynamic that plays out today?
Yeah, I mean, what I found really fascinating about that chapter was, you know, we often think about Māori art as objects in isolation.
Yeah.
That's partly probably because a lot of our contact with customary Māori art is through museums or, you know. But actually, in its time, and to a certain extent today, not as much as it used to be, they were important agents of peace and reconciliation. And when you track them, you know, I've done other projects associated with this. When you track the passage of those taonga through the country, they make epic journeys. And the more that they're passed on to represent some kind of change in relationship, the more mana and tapu they create. So they can be passed. I tracked one that went through the entire country from, you know, from north to south, just acquiring mana through and settling different disputes. So I wanted to look at that. You know, when we think about art, we tend to think, as I said before, about the single object, but actually art within Māori society has this other dynamic to it about being passed on. What we see today is taonga being passed between generations, particularly within families. And many of your listeners would have gone to graduation and seen, you know, family members, they themselves will be graduating and wearing important pieces of clothing, which, you know, could be kākahu Māori, Māori clothing. And those get passed down between generations and they'll attain mana and stories with them. So we're seeing that within families. But this used to happen across whole iwi as well and into iwi relationships too. So just wanted to capture that particular dynamic about Māori art in that chapter.
No, I think it's really, really, really awesome. I think it shows that the role of art in Māori society covers a whole lot of functions. It's more than just, like you say, an object. Some that ties a room together. You know, it's more than that. Much more. Shooting over now into Te Kite Aronui, you've got a really, really interesting piece titled Māori Art as a Cultural Property, which I guess delves into aspects of commercialization of Māori art. Do you think that the genie is out of the bottle there? You know, is it something that we can claw back from and reclaim?
So I have another role where I sit on the Māori Trademarks Advisory Committee of the Intellectual Property Office of New Zealand. Mm-hmm. So any commercial trademark that has a Māori word or image in it actually comes to our committee. And I've been doing that work for 21 years now. So I'm very fortunate I get to see sort of these trends. Where we started from with that, and that's represented in the discussion in the book, was this idea that we wanted to normalise the idea of Māori art in the community and seeing it in different places. And we're seeing it more particularly when it comes to Māori Language Week, with more Māori language being used in different spaces as well. Mm-hmm. So this idea of normalisation, which has a commercial aspect to it as well, and a lot of our work on that committee, and it's talked about in the book too, is ensuring the integrity of Māori art and Māori customs are preserved, you know, in particular around tapu and noa. Mm. So in some respects, it's not so much a genie out of the bottle. I think it's Māori art travelling into different spaces and being represented in different ways. And certainly Māori branding in commercial spaces by Māori companies is really important for them.
Mm.
But it also touches on the idea of cultural appropriation and how Māori art can be taken without permission or without due acknowledgement manipulated in ways which are not helpful to the culture, or even, I would say, to the artist that's using them in that kind of way. So, you know, it, Y262, which you mentioned at the beginning of this interview, is really important for thinking about how we go into the future with that. And our particular focus on Māori art being made by Māori people meant that artists such as Colin McCann and Teo Schoon are kind of only footnotes in that sort of discussion. Mm-hmm. But, you know, others have talked about their contribution and how it might be evaluated by today's lenses. In terms of their use of Māori art in their own work.
Mm-hmm. I guess by the genie out of the bottle, I meant some of the more maybe cynical, culturally appropriative things you might have mentioned there. But in my mind, I have an image of, you know, say it's Matariki and I don't know, Repco is doing a sale on so on and so forth, and they might use some Māori cultural motif. You know, I think that stuff is pretty, you know, it doesn't really represent the culture at all, you know.
Yeah, and it depends where it comes from too. A lot of commercial companies spend a lot of time, and you know, this is an emerging trend, working with Māori designers mm-hmm. through their work. So the real trip up comes when you start using tapu imagery. Mm-hmm. It might be imagery related to the head, body, ancestors, ancestor names, particular types of carved forms, painted forms on noa objects, which would be alcohol,
yeah,
food. You know, there are other noa objects as well. So, you know, it's really important that if someone's putting a product out there, if you want to attract your market, you've got to make sure that you don't insult them through the process.
Very true. Very true indeed. I think we've had a very, very in-depth, fascinating discussion here. I wish I had more time to ask you about a couple other things, but I think we'll have to move over from that. I really want to thank you for your time this morning. I have one more question. I want to know what's next for you for 2024, 2025?
Oh, so I've got a couple of things on the boil. A spin-off project, a book on contemporary Māori architecture, because my training is in architecture and I work at an architecture school. Mm-hmm. I've half written a book on Harakeke Māori, but I'm also co-director of a Māori housing research centre as well, so we're doing some exciting projects mm-hmm. Just to increase the quality and supply of Māori housing for our communities. Mm-hmm. So that's us. I'm busy next year, so I'm sure everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like you wear many hats, so really, really, really admirable. Very, very happy to have you on, Deirdre. It was very fascinating.
Thank you, and thank you for your time, Zach.
Thank you so much. All right, folks, that was Deirdre Brown, who has recently co-authored Toi Te Mana, an Indigenous History of Māori Art, with Ngāri Noa Ellis and Jonathan Mane Fiocchi. You can find this beautiful, beautiful book on aotearoabooks.co.nz, as well as aucklanduniversitypress.co.nz. We're going to play Marlon Williams and Casey Clayton. We're going to play their track Arahura. You're listening to The One. Keep it locked.
Thanks for listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. There are heaps more at r1.co.nz.